ride back and forth. It's an opportunity for me to catch up and to hear a lot of that wisdom that was imparted to me when I was your age, when I had the opportunity to live by Farragut. But I know his words always have just tremendous, tremendous depth and insight. It's a true opportunity for us to have him here with us and to share with us. So I just want to please give your undivided attention and respect.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldfischer. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. So it's now 10:30. And you have 6 hours to change. Next 6 hours will determine whether it's just the day that you fast and eat and move on, or you're a different you. And today is not as tragic as the other fast days, I'll be honest with you. Tish B'Av, the world goes dark. Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. Jerusalem is routed. History is altered. We sit in the corner, we cry, we don't talk. Shabbat Sefer Talmos is like the prequel. 3 weeks before, city is breached. These are days that are replete with tragedy and darkness and historical misfortune. What happened today? Well, the big event, the central event, really didn't all happen today. It happened in the same month. But the fact that it happened in the same month indicated to Chazal, this, remember, Western civilization views history as evolutionary, open-ended, progressive. Judaism views history as cyclical, repetitive, returning to the terminus. So all these events happened in the same month that indicated to Chazal that these events had ominous connotations. I would use the word ominous, not necessarily tragic. There's one event today that was tragic. What's the event today that was tragic? Who knows what happened today?
Siege.
And siege is the first part of the conquest in ancient warfare. But the other two events, I'll be honest with you, they weren't tragic, they were challenging. That's what you make of them. What are the other two events that happened today?
Ezra.
Very good. What's your name?
John.
John, Ezra and Nehemiah.
Yeah.
Again, not today. When I say today, I mean in this month, in Tevet. Now, they didn't die tragically. They weren't young people. They weren't assassinated. They weren't persecuted. They didn't die on Kiddush Hashem. They died. But it was the end of an era, because they were the last Nevi. And now we were faced with the challenge of finding some new response, and we transitioned from a world of prophecy into a world of Parashat Baal Peh, and a world of Chachamim, and a world of Chazal. I was telling some of the kids before, I remember being at Rabbi Soloveitchik's funeral. And I just couldn't imagine a world without Rabbi Soloveitchik in it. It just didn't compute. What does it mean for there to be a world without Rabbi Soloveitchik? Baruch Hashem, we managed the transition. 4 years ago, my Rebbe, Reb Lichtenstein, died. I was broken. I sat in the corner and cried like a baby. The world moves on, and we find other people less caliber, less talented. So the world transitioned from Ezra and Nehemiah, but it's not as if it was this great tragedy. They died, it was the end of an era, and now we're challenged. There was also, of course, a clear sign that their revolution had failed. You see, look around you. Beautiful building, beautiful community. Think a little more broadly. Think of all the communities Jews have built over the last 2,000 years in Poland, in Spain, in Russia, in England, in France, in Morocco, in Yemen, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Syria, in Italy. None of this was ever meant to happen. It's all a mirage. Had the Jews returned with Ezra and Nehemiah in mass, the second Beit HaMikdash would have been utopia, Mashiach, end of history, all Jews in history in Israel. And not just Jewish history would have changed, human history would have changed. All the suffering, all the war and bloodshed of the last 2,000 years would never have occurred. Anyone know how many Jews returned with Ezra and Nehemiah from Babel? How many Jews returned with Ezra and Nehemiah from Babel? 42,000. Most Jews stayed in Babel. And you know why they stayed in Babel? Because it was too comfortable. Because living in Israel was challenging, because it was hard to earn a living, and there was a lot of terror. Sound familiar? Listen to what I just said. Chazal said, this is a Gemara Megillah. Had all the Jews returned with Ezra and Nehemiah, history, can you imagine going back in a time machine and changing history? and getting all the Jews out of Persia, and out of Shushan, and out of Babel, getting them to Israel, everything is different. Everything just vaporizes, like in a movie. Everything you see out there changes before your very eyes. And you're all Israelis, and you all speak Hebrew, and we all live in Yerushalayim, and we have a Beis HaMikdash, and the world's very different. But now we're stuck with this world. And when Ezra and Nehemiah died, it was the end of that potential. Somehow, the Jews aren't coming back, despite Ezra and Nehemiah's best intentions. It's not a tragedy, it's a misfortune. It's the end of an era. What else happened today? Ezra and Nehemiah died. What else happened? City was laid siege. What's the third event that happened? Anyone know?
Torah was translated into Greek.
Torah was translated into Greek. By whom?
So I believe it was by 70.
There you go. Excellent. What's your name?
Asher.
70 scholars were gathered by King Ptolemy in the Greek culture, the Greek influenced city in Egypt. He was an Egyptian king, but he was under Greek influence. When did it happen? Anyone know? About 100 years before Hanukkah. And the Torah was translated into Greek. Is that a happy event or a misfortune? A sad event.
Sad.
Well, it's sad. And the Gemara says that for 3 days there was a darkness that descended on the world. But it wasn't a tragedy. It was a challenge. And let me tell you what that challenge was. You'll appreciate it a little bit more. A week ago, you were finishing Hanukkah. So think about Hanukkah and the translation of the Torah by the 70 scholars into Greek. Until Hanukkah, Judaism never had a real competition, because Judaism was squaring off against barbarism, savagery, cannibalism, antiquity, these ancient people who drank each other's blood, consumed their flesh, ran from mountain to mountain, lived with animals, basically Neanderthal man. The confrontation with Greece, that was really the first time that Judaism met a worthy competitor. Because Greece was the first culture that actually built a civilization, that organized their world, that developed science and architecture and mathematics and culture and rudimentary democracy and some form of equality and a stable life. Do you know the word cosmos? Is a Greek word, which means what? What does cosmos mean in Greece? Order. Because before Greece, the world was seen as a random, frightening, untamed, uncontrollable world of wild animals and random causes that affected human experience. And the Greeks were able to build a scientific method to predict and to control their world. And now, Judaism was confronting civilization, and that's savagery. Another world that had organized itself and built stable societies and ethics and morality and democracy. Or rudimentary democracy. That's what made Hanukkah so pivotal, so iconic. That the Jews were able to withstand not the challenges of savage cannibals, but the challenge of the Greek world. But something else is happening in Hanukkah. Were the Greeks paganists? No. They worship stones and idols, planets, oceans, fish, animals, wind. No. Gods were seen as spiritual beings. The world of paganism is ending. The world of Avodah Zarah is starting to shrink. For the first time, man realizes that his God is not physical. It's not Ma'aseh Yedei Adam. It's not Elohei Masecha. It's not something you build. They're something beyond. The fancy word for that in English is they're transcendent. The gods are transcendent. History is changing. And we're changing history. We were put on this world to represent Hashem and to convey two messages to this world. Listen carefully to our messages. One message is the message of monotheism. Hashem isn't physical. And that everything in this world is diverse and is dichotomous. As it was. Those are two different things. One is diverse. How could all this diversity come from one God? There are trees. There's grass. There's metal. There's earth. There's cement. There's plastic. There's wind. There's sun. There's coal. If you landed today in India, and you asked a Buddhist how many gods he has, or Hinduism, 33 million, I think, in Hinduism. Because every single element of our world has a god. What does it mean for this sprawling reality, this great chain of being, to all stem from one being? And it's not just diverse, it's also dichotomous. It's not going to be the same God be responsible for good and evil, for light and darkness, for celebration and suffering, for day and night. How could it? We've stood tall for that message throughout history. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. All of reality, you can get into a spaceship and travel to the outer limits of our universe, it's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's nothing in reality that wasn't created by the Rabbanu Shalom. And our second message to the world is the message of morality. That Hashem is kind, and Hashem is compassionate, and Hashem cares for humanity, and He wants human beings to be prosperous, and He wants human beings to have welfare, and we're supposed to be agents of that welfare. And right around now, right around the Hanukkah episode, right around 300 BCE, right around now, humanity is starting to inch its way on both fronts to create more moral and stable societies as Greece did, and also to start to envision their gods in a non-physical way as Greece did. If you want a fancy word for it, the Greeks were not paganists, they were polytheists. They believed in spiritual gods, but many gods, Zeus and Apollo and Mercury and Diana. And each force had a god, but the gods weren't physical. They couldn't understand Hashem Echad. They couldn't get the Achdus. They couldn't get the sense that one god could capture and create it all. But you know what? It's starting. It's starting. History is moving forward. 100 years before Hanukkah, the Torah is translated. 150 years before Hanukkah, Alexander the Great visits Jerusalem. And he meets Shimon HaTzadik. And he gets off of his horse. And he bows down to Shimon HaTzadik. And his associates say, "Why are you bowing down to this Jew? You're Alexander the Great. You have conquered the entire world, Alexander of Macedonia." And he says, "Because every night before I triumph in war, this man came to me in a dream. I know there's something special with this man and with this temple." And he laid, let the temple exist, and he conquered the base of Mikdash. So the Greek culture realizes that for them to advance their world scientifically and religiously, they need to go to Jerusalem and draw inspiration from Jerusalem. And the Greeks in Egypt know that in order for them to advance their world, we've got to take our Torah of monotheism, our Torah of morality, and translate it, and seek its wisdom, and understand it, and spread its ideas. And in some crazy way, Hanukkah is part of that, because it's still Greece trying to draw us, in this case, not draw us, but convert us. But it's not annihilation. Greece, Hanukkah isn't genocide, it's not purge. They're not looking to kill Jews. They're looking to draw Jewish wisdom into Greece, and to detach us from our tradition. The Greeks told the Jews, you have to write on the horn of your animals that you no longer belong to God, you're part of Greek culture. We're not part of Jewish history of the desert, we're part of Greek culture of Athens. We're part of Greek culture of Mass. We're part of Greek culture of the Seleucids. But history is changing before our eyes. In the 13th century, Judaism was put on trial in Barcelona. Anyone know who defended Judaism in the great trial of Barcelona? There was a Jew converted to Christianity, Pablo Cristiani, and he accused and he riled up, fomented the king against Jews in the Talmud, and Jews in the Talmud were put on trial. Who defended the Jews? Ramban. Very good. Did he win or did he lose? Of course he lost, because it was a predetermined verdict. It was a monkey kangaroo trial. And the Jewish community of Barcelona was really depressed. So the Ramban wrote a sefer, a small little sefer. You know what he called the sefer? Taras Hashem Tamima. Anyone here named Tamima? I wrote his name, Tamima. Taras Hashem Tamima. And he told the Jews, I want you to understand something. From a historical standpoint, Christianity and Islam They're great tragedies because they persecute the Jews. But from a religious standpoint, Christianity and Islam are welcome developments. Because these are two religions that lift ideas from the dark and they spread them across the world. I don't have the time to go to South America and convert the Mayans into Christians and Hindus. Christianity did that. I don't have the time to go to Southern Asia and convert the cannibals into monotheists. Islam did that. Islam and Christianity lifted ideas from the Torah, of course corrupted them, and distorted some of them. But it's a far better world to live in than the world that our ancestors inhabited, with paganists and idolatrous who drank each other's blood and worshipped idols. And let me tell you a personal admission. Can't share this with anyone. If you're recording, please shut it now. Just kidding. I don't live in America, so I don't live under the cultural barrage of Christmas and Christmas carols and Christmas trees and Christmas gifts. I don't even know what it is. So it doesn't affect me. When I'm on planes, and when I interact, when I come, I normally come to America this time of year, I say Merry Christmas to flight attendants or to people at the desk or people in the supermarket or whatever. And I wish them happy holidays. At some level, I'm happy that Christianity and that they're celebrating a notion, a corrupted notion, but a notion that God isn't physical, that God is transcendent and other and different and indescribable. There's a lot of paganism in Christianity, of course. Of course, I said never have a son, Chas v'Shalom, Chalila v'Chas, but when Mashiach comes, he's going to come to a world that's almost ready for full monotheism. We've done Mashiach's job for him. This world is a monotheistic world, and we've turned it into a monotheistic world. My Rebbe Rav Amital would tell us the following story about a man in a shtetl whose name was Mendele. And Mendele's job was to wake the entire shtetl up during Chodesh Elul. Come up, get up, it's time for davening. He was relentless. He would pull you out of your bed if you were sleeping. He'd throw water on you. Mendele kept the whole shtetl up for Chodesh Elul, slichos and davening. And now, Erev Rosh Hashanah, and everyone's in shul saying their slichos, and Mendel's exhausted. He's sleeping. Everyone in shul takes the little pieces of paper, and they cross it at Mendel to wake him up. And Mendel looks at them with his eyes bloodshot. He says, I'm exhausted. Can you let me go to sleep? Can you just let me sleep a little during slichos? So the entire shtetl looks at Mendel and says, Mendel, you kept us up all Chodesh Elul. You kept us awake all Chodesh Elul. You didn't let us sleep. You think we're going to let you go to sleep now or at Rosh Hashanah? You kept us awake. We're going to let you get some shluf. Rav Amital told us that we are the world's Mendel. We kept the world awake for 2,000 years. We refused to let them believe in idols and paganism. We challenged them. We refuse to let them create immoral societies. We challenge them. We challenge the world. We kept the world morally awake for 2,000 years. And now, all we want to do is go to sleep in our country and rest. And now the world is looking at us and saying, Mendele, you kept us awake for 2,000 years. You think we're going to let you go back to Israel and just go to sleep? We'll throw things at you. We'll try to keep you awake. We're the world's conscience. Har Sinai is called Har Sinai because at the moment we were chosen to be whistleblowers, anti-Semitism launched. Anti-Semitism isn't random, isn't based on white supremacist notions of us compromising the national character of America. It isn't based on hyper-liberal views that we're the colonialists who run an apartheid state. It's all just a kind of story. We challenged the world, and we started challenging the world at Har Sinai, and it was called Har Sinai because that's when Sinai began. The Gemara says, and Shabbos take us. And you should be proud to be the victim of anti-Semitism. I didn't mean that. Just trying to get your attention. When it happens, you should realize why it's happening. And you should be proud as to why it's happening. Doesn't mean you shouldn't try to avert it and curtail it and prevent it, but it's not because some skinhead hates you. Because we believe in metaphysical forces that are untraceable to human cognition. If you introduce your average anti-Semite and you ask them why do you hate a Jew, he won't say, oh, because of Parsina. Because the Jews are the conscience of the world. But a Jew doesn't just believe in cerebral physics, but in metaphysics. There are larger forces driving human experience that we may not be able to trace, but that exist. And Chazal speak about it in the Gemara and Shabbos. All this begins when Asarah B'Tavis, when the Torah is translated into Greek. It's the first time the Torah is translated, and you're now going to be starting the thirst for current knowledge. And that's the dilemma of today. And it's the dilemma of Christianity, and to a lesser degree, the dilemma of Islam. Because if we're going to share our values, and we're meant to share our values, they're going to be corrupted. It's inevitable. But we'd rather those values disseminate and permeate the world, even if they have to be corrupted, than remaining and retaining an insular Torah that doesn't affect humanity. Just think of your history. The Torah was translated around 300 BCE. Anyone know when the Roman Empire becomes Christian who studied history? When does the emperor all of a sudden convert the Roman Empire?
323.
I thought it was the 5th century, but maybe the 4th century. And when does Muhammad arrive on the scene? 6th century. 800 years later, the world's a different place. 800 years later, the world is predominantly monotheist. 800 years later, Torah values, more or less, in a very corrupted way, are starting to worm their way into the human consciousness. Why do you think on Hanukkah so many Jews became Hellenists? Because there's a cultural contact, there's a cultural interaction, there's a cultural cross-pollination. We weren't defeating enemies, we were trying to inspire enemies. So that's what I'd like you to think about for today. I'd like you to think about what it means to be a Jew, and that we carry the world on our shoulders, and we are responsible for every single human being and their welfare. Remember about 15 years ago, how much time do we have?
Yeah, 6 hours.
How much time do we have for this lesson?
6 minutes.
Okay, 6 minutes for a story. About 18 years ago, I spent an incredibly intense day in Chicago. I took the early flight from New York, which I believe left at 6, maybe 5:30. I had shiurim to give. I had interviews. I had to go to a wedding. I show up at the airport. It's 10 o'clock at night. I'm exhausted. I've been up since 3 in the morning. And I see the dreaded words, delayed. My flight's delayed. I don't know if I should land. I wait, and I wait, and I wait, and I wait. And now it's 1:30 in the morning, and they announce the plane is taking off for LaGuardia. I feel like $1 million. I'm getting back to New York. It'll be crazy, it'll be late, but I'm back. And you know what? I've got 2 hours where no one knows my name. No one's going to speak to me. I can just learn. So excited. I'm getting home, and I have 2 hours free to learn. Walk to the back of the plane. I turn to the person next to me. I want to be courteous. Say, have a pleasant flight. He says, have a pleasant flight. I sit down and start learning. He's a bit of a nosy body. He says, what are you reading? I was learning Gemara. I said, ancient Jewish law. He says, what topic are you reading about? I was learning Maseches Nida. I said, ancient Jewish hygiene. But that was good. And then he says the 5 words I least wanted him to say. He could have said any 5 words in the dictionary. He could have Googled, randomized 5 words. He could have read 5 words from Shakespeare. He says, oh, don't worry, I'm a Jew. And I say, oh, Kodesh Baruch, I've been working with you for 20 hours, from 3 in the morning till 1 in the morning. So can't you sit? I just want to learn. I don't want to have to talk to this Jew via Makarifim. Can't you just sit me next to a Buddhist monk or an Irish priest or a student? Why? But you know what? You know the choice. If Kodesh Baruch Hu calls your number, you say your name. So I start making small talk with this guy. What do you do for a living? He's a professor at MIT. So I'm a Rebbe in Gush. Right off the bat, we have something in common. I start giving him some tips, teaching tips, he's a little younger, pedagogy skills, how to organize his lessons properly. He says, Rabbi, are you married? Baruch Hashem, I'm married. I love my wife to death. I don't understand something. I can fall in love with a woman and our trajectories will overlap and intersect, but my trajectory will continue growing this way and her trajectory will keep growing that way, and they'll deviate, we'll no longer be overlapping, and how can we stay married? I was trying to explain to this physics professor that marriage isn't physics. Not vectors and trajectories and angles. Not physics. No, it really is. It's chemistry. And then he says, somewhere he says, in the Holy Appalachians, he says, Rabbi, I always wanted to know. Oh, that's a shock. I was waiting for that question. I always wanted to know what makes Judaism different. We have our traditions, they have their traditions. What makes Judaism different? It was a long flight back. I'll tell you only one thing I told him. I said, do you know that we are the most universalistic religious? I said, Rabbi, what are you talking about? Universalistic? Chosen people, God's children, that's bigotry, that's racism. But let me tell you something. Do you know that for every Christian in this world, you have a bullseye in your back? Because their end game is converting you to Christianity or eliminating you as the infidel. Do you know that for every Muslim, you have a bullseye on your back? Because their end game is converting you to Islam or eliminating you as the infidel. And Islamic fundamentalism has already begun that project. We're the only religion that has absolutely no conversion agenda. We're completely and totally disinterested in any additional person ever becoming Jewish. Doesn't interest us. We are meant to live a life in front of Hashem of higher commandment and greater sensitivity and more finely tuned. Show the world what it is to live before Hashem. We show the world the dignity, the nobility, the meaning, the greatness. So you'll be able to look at me and say, oh, that's what it is to live before Hashem. That's what it is to be moral. That's what it is to be kind. That's what it is to have community. That's what it is to have family. And therefore, I, as a Gentile, I will keep my seven. I won't kill, I won't murder, I won't maim, I won't steal, I won't commit infidelity. We are the most universalistic religion. And that's what a Jew is. A Jew is both. Let me tell you where I live. I live in the West Bank. And do you know that by my settlement in the West Bank, that is the most universalist agenda I can choose? I'm trying to bring Mashiach and change the world forever. And we'll eliminate poverty and cancer and suffering and bloodshed and strife. And I can only get to Mashiach, and I can only get Hashem's intervention if I learn, study, teach, and etc. The world is still
That's why they're still opposing it.
But even though they're casting us as parochialists and tribalists, globalists and nationalists, don't let them set your narrative. We will resist. Every mitzvah you perform, every black tomorrow you learn, every mitzvah, you're still a better Jew. You're becoming a better Jew. You're deepening Hashem's presence in this world. You're deepening Hashem's presence in this world. You bring about a better world for everyone. So if you ask me, am I sad that the Torah was translated into Greek? I'm ambivalent. It's necessary. It's going to lead to distortion. We don't live in a perfect world. But I know one thing. That was the start of the world that we know. And it's a far better world to live in than the world of the pagans and the cannibals. Have a meaningful fast and think about that. It's okay too.
Rabbi, what period is it now?
Seven.
What's your name? Anyway? Annie, you up? What's your name?
Shoshana Distanpa.